great crowd. I want to welcome everybody here, and I want to welcome everybody. We have this little Zoom thing going on here, and everybody in Cyberland. And this is fun. Wow. You know, for the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking, well, you know, maybe I had to start memorizing lines out of the big book. and I could incorporate these, but I already know a lot of lines in the big book, you know, and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And I kind of want to talk about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And, you know, I was talking about reading the big book. And when I went to school, reading was not my favorite subject. And neither was school. I like PE and I like shop. But as far as the rest of it went, I wasn't too much interested in it. And but I did show up all the time. I never cut class. And a little history. My father was a narcotics agent for the state of California. And I remember when I was 9 years old, we lived in Fresno, and he took me over to West Fresno. And there was all these people, you know, and they were sitting along the buildings, and they had a little bag next to them, you know, with a wine bottle in it or whatever they were drinking. And he said to me, he goes, "See all those people?" And I go, "Yeah. I mean, I'm 9 years old, you know." He goes, "They're all heroin addicts, and they ran out of money, so now they're drinking wine." And that stuck in my head, you know, for the rest of my life, you know. And I was never, ever going to do any drugs because, you know, I don't want to be a wino. I mean, and that's kind of where I ended up. But anyway, I had my first drink at, I was about 13 years old. And this is when I used to be the remote control on the TV. They had three channels and a knob. And my dad would say, "Put it on channel whatever, you know." But they had, you know, they had these cowboy and Indian shows all the time, little half-hour series. And the theme was the cowboy, the good guy would wear the white hat, and the bad guy would wear the black hat. And they'd go to the bar, and they'd both take a shot of whiskey, and they'd punch each other. And the white guy would always win the fight. And they were my heroes. I wanted to be, well, not necessarily the guy with the white hat, but, you know, I wanted that whiskey. And I was just a little guy, you know. Never had whiskey before. But my dad, he had to go pick up a prisoner in Bronzeville, Texas. And that's where the prisoner was. But while he was over there, they took him down to Mexico, the police officers down there, you know, to show him a good time. Well, he came back and he bought tequila for everybody in the office, a case of tequila for everybody in his office. So he had all this tequila and he had a case of tequila at home. So I'm thinking, I just got through watching one of those cowboy movies where they're beating each other up, and I'm going, "Well, this kind of looks like whiskey." And I pull it out of his little medicine cabinet, you know, and I had seven shots of that stuff. And I was, you know, I was 13 years old. I was not old enough to drive yet. I got on my bicycle and rode down the street, and my bicycle was my horse. And I'm wahooing it down the road, you know, and we kind of lived, it was sort of country-ish. And there was a little ditch at the end of the road, and there was about 6 inches of water in this ditch. And by the time I got to that ditch, things were spinning. And I said to myself, well, if I just wash my face off, I'll be fine. Right? And the next thing I remember, I was laying flat on my face in the ditch, you know, and the water was running over me. And I went, wow, you know, and I ended up walking my bicycle home because I couldn't ride it. I was way too drunk. And this is my first drunk. And I remember getting home and puking all over everything. But the feeling I had was I was free. For that moment, I was free. I had no more fear, you know, and I felt on top of the world. And even though I was sicker than a dog, I couldn't wait to do it again, you know. And I became one of these weekend drinkers, you know, for part of my high school. And then I got a car and all that, you know, I was 16 years old, I got a car and a license and I used to keep a half pint in my glove box. And in between classes in high school at 16, I was going out there and taking a couple of shots, you know, so I could cope with the rest of the school day. But that's how it all got started. And I was always kind of attracted to the dark side, you know, the motorcycle gangs and there was several motorcycle gangs at that time, and I used to go to their parties and hang out with them, but I didn't have a bike yet. I had just turned 18 years old, graduated from high school. And my dad got me a job in Modesto, California. And I was a apprentice diesel mechanic for a dealership. And my drinking just took off because I was no longer at home. And it just exploded there, you know. And my cousin called me up. He lived up in the Bay Area, and he says, "You want to go to Tahoe this weekend?" And I go, "Sure." And he came down with his buddy and picked me up on Friday, and we went up to Lake Tahoe. And Saturday morning, I got a hangover and everything. We walk into a Safeway store, and my cousin's friend was with me, and I handed him I'm looking at stuff and I'm hungry, you know. And I'm looking at stuff, and I hand my friend my wallet, and I said, "Hold this until I get out, you know." And I grabbed a can of sardines off of the shelf and stuck it in my back pocket. Looked just like a wallet. Walked out the door, and here's his hand on my shoulder. Boom! And they took me into their little office, called the cops. And this is Saturday morning, early. They kept me in the jail cell. Well, let me tell you what happened in the jail cell. I'm the first one in there. There's four bunks. The next guy comes in, and he's ranting and raving, I'm innocent. And I'm sitting there scratching my head. I go, well, I don't know. I didn't say nothing, you know, but I knew. I was saying to myself, I'm guilty. So the next guy comes in. He was innocent, too. So I'm in this cell with two innocent guys, and I'm guilty. And then the third guy come in, and he took the fourth bunk, and he was innocent, too. And I couldn't figure out why they were throwing these innocent people into jail, you know, because I knew I was guilty. They kept me in there till Monday morning, about 11 o'clock in the morning. And then they drug me into the courtroom, and the judge, you know, I mean, he read off the charge of shoplifting and all that, and gave me a fine, and told me if I ever see you in here again and all that, you know, he's going to throw everything together and blah, blah. So my cousin, he split, you know, he is already gone, and I hitchhiked back to Modesto, and in the morning when the sun was coming up, in Modesto, and I said to myself, the best thing to do is to tell my boss the truth. And so I did that. I told my boss the truth, and he fired me. So I'm just bumming around, you know, nothing to do. And I got a, and this is when the Vietnam War was starting to go. And I guess they had a draft. I wasn't paying attention to the draft. You know, I was not concerned about the draft. But I said, but I didn't have a job, nothing going on. And I said to myself, well, I'm going to join the service. You know, they'll give me a cot and three meals and, you know, and it'll be fine. They'll pay me. So I went to the Air Force and they wanted me to take a test. I'm going, a test? Okay. So I took this test and I passed the test. And I always thought, no offense to anybody that was in the Air Force, but the people I ran with, you know, the Air Force was kind of a wimpy organization. So anyway, so then, you know, he gave me his little spill and I said, well, I'll think about it. And then I went over to the Navy and the Navy, you know, they're, I took another test for the Navy, you know, and I passed it. And the Navy guy said, I got to tell you one thing. And I go, what's that? And he goes, well, when you join the Navy, you know, it's 4 years and you're going to have 2 years of sea duty. The first thought in my head, 18 years old, was, I'm not going to be able to drink for 2 years. Be on a boat for 2 years and not be able to drink? No way. This is not for me, you know. So then I went over to the Army. And this guy was like a used car salesman. And he had his little thing spilled down. And I wasn't buying used cars, you know. And so the last place for me to go was the Marine Corps. And I went up there. It was up on the third floor of this building. And he's got dress blues on, and he's looking really sharp, spit-shine shoes. And he's telling me, you know, all about the Marine Corps. And I said, well, I'll think about it. I'm going to go have lunch. And I walked out his door, and right across the hall was the elevator, and I jumped in the elevator, and he yells at me, hold that elevator, I'm going to lunch too. And he got in the elevator, and he goes, what do you think of this uniform? I go, sharp. Yeah, really sharp. And he goes, you know you have to earn this uniform. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, you have to go through Marine Corps boot camp. And once you get through Marine Corps boot camp, you have earned the right to wear this uniform. And I go, yeah, really? You know, and my ears are all perking up, you know. And then he says, and you know one more thing? And I go, what's that? And he goes, after you've earned this uniform, you can put this uniform on, go into any bar, anywhere, and any girl in there is yours. And I said, where do I sign? Another one of them character defects, you know. So off I went into the Marine Corps. And I had a couple of years in, and they sent me to Vietnam, and that was a whole different experience. And anyway, I got out of the Marine Corps, and I thought I earned my right to be free. You know, I had served my time and you know, for my country and all that, and now I could do whatever I want. I did not put the plug in the jug. I mean, I ran across this one guy. He was a friend of mine. And there was three groups of people. I'm going to tell you the three groups of people I hung out with. He liked to drink whiskey and pop Benzedrine, you know, the little bitties. So we'd take a half a dozen bitties and open a bottle of whiskey, a fifth, and throw the lid out the window because we don't need the lid anymore. It's going to be gone. And we would go cruising. That's what we did. The other group of people that I hung out with, they liked, They like Sekondal and heroin and stuff like that. And we'd go over to their house all jacked up at midnight, and they would be all laying on the floor, you know. And we tried to get a party started, and they wouldn't be going. But the other group of people, there was this guy, he spent 5 years in India studying under a guru. And you know, he was into meditation and stuff, you know. But his business was selling peyote. But anyway, he used to go down to New Mexico. He had a school bus, and he'd bring back gunny sacks full of peyote, you know. And he'd come by. I was renting this little ranch, and I was growing tomatoes, and he'd trade me peyote buttons for tomatoes, you know. But anyway, you know, as time went on, you know, that kind of clicked me into some kind of a spiritual kind of consciousness, which I knew nothing about. But he was like the guy that kind of introduced me to some spiritual things, you know. And it always stuck in my mind that I was always seeking that. And I ended up getting married. Well, I got married right out of boot camp and then got divorced when I got out of the service. But then I ended up getting married again, and we had two kids together. And she was a member of Al-Anon. And when I started drinking more and more, she joined Al-Anon. And she'd come home with these pamphlets, and she'd put them on my chair where I sat. And I'd look at these pamphlets and put them on the coffee table and put my drink on them. That's what I didn't want to put rings on the coffee table, you know. I mean, that's what I did. And so I picked up a drunk driving ticket, and she bailed me out, you know, a good Al-Anon. And so Monday morning, I said to her, I go, I'm going to go to one of them AA meetings that you're always talking about. And she goes, she just rolled her eyes at me, you know. And so my thinking is, this is when they had phone books. They didn't have, you know, these things. And I knew that since it was Alcoholics Anonymous, it wouldn't be in the phone book because it's anonymous. That's my alcoholic thinking. I opened the phone book up to the A's, and there it is, like the second one or something. Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I said, well, God, I promised I would, you know, call them, you know. So I called them, and I guess it was central office or something that somebody working there, teleservice or something. And this gal is all happy and joyful and everything, and I'm miserable because I got a drunk driving and I got a hangover. And she's telling me about all these meetings, and this is Monday morning. And I said to her, I go, well, I was kind of looking for meetings that veterans go to. Does any veterans go to those meetings? And there was a big pause on the other end of the line for a minute. And she goes, well, yeah, veterans go to these meetings. And then I said, because I'm real special, I said, I want a meeting that only veterans go to. And then there's another pause on the line. And then she comes back and says, there's a meeting on Wednesday night at the VA hospital. I'll bet there's a whole bunch of veterans going to that one. My mind says, Wednesday night, that's 3 days. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I got 3 more days of drinking. That's how I thought. You know, I was a daily drinker at the end. And so I show up to this meeting, and there wasn't any chairs set up. I like to be prompt when I'm somewhere, so I was early. And there's me and the secretary. And so I helped the secretary set up all the chairs and stuff, and I had a six pack before I went in because I needed courage. So anyway, got it all set up, and I sat right in the front row, and the secretary came up and said, "Would you read a portion of chapter 5 for us?" I don't know what chapter 5 is, and I was kind of reading handicapped all through school. You know, I mean, I didn't read very well, but I said yes. For some reason, I said yes. And so the meeting starts. He asked me to read a portion of chapter 5, and it took so long to get through that thing. I thought the meeting was going to be over by the time I finished it. But I got through it, and it was like super stressful, and I did it, you know. And then they were talking. The only thing I heard in that meeting was, all you need is the desire to stop drinking. That's what I heard. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, this thing's all about willpower. I think I could do that, you know. I was in the Marine Corps. They taught me willpower, you know. They didn't teach me anything about surrender, but surrender was like, that was unheard of. So the meeting's over. I leave. I jump in the elevator, and two guys jump in the elevator behind me, you know, 12-step me, you know. I'm figuring, I knew all this later on, you know, I figured this all out. But, they're going to 12-step me. And one guy looks at the other guy and he goes, "Boy, you can sure tell who's been drinking in this elevator." And I'm looking at the other two guys trying to figure out which one was drinking. So anyway, I get home and I tell my ex-wife, I said, "They told me the secret." And she said, "What's that?" I said, "All you need is a desire to stop drinking." And I got that. You know, I got this drunk driving. I got the desire. I'm done. And I stayed sober for 3 months without going to another meeting. And one day, I was out working on my ranch, and it was hot in August. And I said, "I got this down now. It's hot out here. I need a cold beer. That's what I need." I went to the liquor store, bought the tallest beer they had, drank it down, and a week later, I'm back in the drunk tank. And I don't remember that whole week. It was gone. But I remember waking up in the drunk tank, you know, with another drunk driving. And anyway, I don't know how long it was after that. It wasn't very long, maybe a week. I come home one day and the house was empty. The kids were gone. All the furniture was gone. Everything was gone. And she even took my TV. I mean, that was the only thing keeping me sort of sane, sort of. Or was it at the bar? But anyway, I had two cases of beer in the house. And what I said to myself is, now I can drink like I want. You know, no more hiding it. And I started to do that. I started opening the beers up and sitting in the middle of the floor drinking them. And then I said to myself, I wonder what's going on at the bar. And so away I went. I went to Clovis, which was about 15, 20 miles from my house. And I started hanging out at the, it was a place called the 500 Club. And I'm sitting there. And I was gambling there, too. That was another addiction I had. I was playing cards. And I didn't know how much money I was spending until after I got sober and I was going through my checkbook and seeing every third check was for $50 to the 500 Club, you know. I was spending money like crazy. I picked up another drunk driving, and so that made three. Oh, I wanted to tell you about my first drunk driving. When I went to court on that, at the time, drunk was 1.0 or 0.10 or whatever it is. And that was my breathalyzer test. It was right on the mark. But they wrote me a drunk driving ticket. And I told the judge, I said, well, I'm innocent. And he goes, well, how can you be innocent? And I go, I wasn't drunk. 0.10, whatever. I wasn't drunk. Yeah. Later on, I was waking up with 2.0 or something. But anyway, then I looked him right in the eye, the judge, and I said, I want a jury trial. And he goes, do you have a lawyer? And I go, no. So anyway, whatever happened, you know, the public defender got, you know, started talking to me, and he goes, if we drop this to a reckless driving, will you take it? And I said, okay. Because at least it wasn't drunk driving, you know. But anyway, so I got my third one, and then what I was noticing, they were pulling me over closer and closer in time together. You know, like the last one I got was a month prior to the one before it, the third one. And I got the fourth one, and the cop knew my name. He pulled me over, and there was this, the pretty busy street in Clovis, out of Clovis, and there was a frontage road and a divider strip, and then this busy street. And he pulled me over, and he says, Louis, you been drinking again? And I go, well, yes. And he goes, well, you know what to do. Put your hands behind your back. And I go, well, wait a minute. I want the sobriety test. Because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking I might pass it. So he says, come on over here. Let's get on the frontage road. And this divider strip is only about this wide, you know. And the cop tripped over the divider strip and fell flat on his face. And I looked at him and said, hey, who's been drinking here, me or you? So anyway, away I went again. And that was my bottom. But what happened in that jail cell, the guy that was booking me, I think was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to look back at all this. Oh, my breathalyzer was 0.31 or 3.1, whatever. Anyway, it was pretty up there. They were surprised I was still upright. Thank God for black beauties. Kept me from falling down. But anyway, the guy that was booking me, I think, was in AA, because he was talking to me and he was saying all this stuff and I didn't know what he was talking about. He was talking about a higher power could relieve my obsession to drink. And I'm thinking, well, this guy is a religious nut, and if I just play it cool and agree to everything he's saying, then he'll keep talking to me and he won't put me in the jail cell. Well, it worked. And it worked for about a half an hour, you know, and I acted real interested in what he was saying. And I have no idea what he was saying. But anyway, the routine for, he finally said, I got to put you in the cell. I got to get back to work. But the routine is they let you out at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they push you out the door and away you go. And so at 6 in the morning, what I was going to do was go to the liquor store and get a bottle. That was my plan. And they told me, they said, go over to this window and get your papers. He impounded your car last night. And I go, okay. And I go up to the window, and the guy looks at me and he goes, what do you want? And I said, I want my papers for my car. I got to get it out of impoundment. And he looked at me and he said, you're still too drunk. Come back at noon. I go, noon? It's 6 in the morning. That's 6 hours. What am I going to do for 6 hours?
Here you go, sir.
Oh, thank you. So I bummed around clothes for 6 hours because I knew something that guy said. In the guy that was booking me, I knew if I had a drink, that I wasn't getting my car. I knew that. And I also knew, well, I'll say that one later. But so I stayed sober for 6 hours, went back, got my car, got my papers in the car, and went home and crashed because I hadn't been to sleep yet. And then I had 24 hours of sobriety. And then I said to myself, which is out of the blue, maybe I could just not drink today. And I had never said that in my life. Maybe I could just not drink today. So I drank, you know, I didn't drink. I had 48 hours of sobriety. Then I called my counselor, which they put me in this 1 year outpatient thing, and I'm supposed to do all, you know, they had rules, and drinking was not one of them. And she says, get down here right now. And I went down there, and she says, I want you to start going to AA. And she gave me a court thing to have signed, and I started going to AA. And things started changing. I didn't drink. 4.5 months of sobriety, they told me, you got to be of service. We want you to take this meeting. I said, I can't. I only got 4.5 months. You got to have 6 months. And they said, it'll be all right. We won't tell anybody if you don't. I go, okay. So that meeting saved my life because I knew I couldn't drink between Friday and Friday, you know, and I had to do it for 6 months. And then I remember this one guy I was using for a sponsor. He took me to this meeting, and they handed out chips like this, and I got my 30-day chip. Man, 30 days without drinking for a daily drinker? I mean, that was pretty good, you know. And I was so proud of myself, you know. So, you know, time kept going on, and then I was going to this meeting, and I don't know if anybody knows where Easton, California is. I was going to Easton, and I walked in there for the Wednesday meeting, and they had a birthday cake for me. 1 year. Wow, 1 year of sobriety. What a miracle, you know. And by that time, I had a sponsor that opened up that big book and took me through it and showed me, you know, the 12 steps, and we went through the 12 steps. And when I got here, I knew I was powerless over alcohol when I finally stayed. And my life was a total wreck, you know. And I didn't know I was broke until after I got sober. That's when the bill collector started calling. Didn't have any money. My bookkeeping system, I had these strawberry boxes. And I'd throw the mail in, and I'd on the side was over what month it was, and they were stacked up about that high in my living room, unopened mail, in sobriety. So, anyway, I wanted to talk about service a little bit. My sponsor immediately had me going into service. He had me take meetings into the county jail, Fresno County Jail. He had me take meetings into Fresno Care and Guidance, a lockup nut ward. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, I don't know why my sponsor wants me to go there. And then he had me taking meetings into juvenile hall. And then when I got 2 years of sobriety, they made me a general service representative, a GSR, for the group, Clovis Fellowship at that time. And I started going to, you know, some assemblies and things and started learning about that kind of stuff. And later on in my sobriety, Well, I became a GSR again for a couple of other groups, and then I became a DCM, District Committee Member for District 43. And I was going up to Sacramento once a month to their meetings, the DCM meetings. And I got to meet a whole new range of people, you know, from Northern California. And, wow, what an adventure. And sobriety has really, really, really blessed me. I have been in other countries, in other meetings. And I remember going to, we were in Amsterdam and found a meeting in Amsterdam. And there was somebody there from San Francisco. A miracle, right from my home state, you know. And there was a guy from England there, and he followed me all around Amsterdam asking me questions. And I was afraid to give him my phone number because of the charges to London. I still had this cheapskate thing. and my MO was to get something for nothing. I love getting free stuff, you know. But, I'm kind of growing out of that, you know. My sobriety date is March 28th, 1981. He made the deal. I just celebrated 41 years. Oh, and one little story. This last weekend, I don't know how many people made it to the ACUPAW conference, but I was at the ACUPAW conference, and they had the countdown. This just really, really took me. But they had groups of people all around the convention center there inside. And they would ask for, you know, whatever years it was you had, and they would run up and congratulate the person, you know. Where they had bleachers and they had people on the floor, and so anyway, there was one gal, and I knew her daughter, but this one gal had 51 years, and they took her up to the stage, and then. The next one, I guess, was me, and they said 40 years, and I raised my hand because I was like 2 days shy of 41 years. And they come running over there with these flags and everything, and said, come on, come on. And I thought they were just going to take me around in a circle, you know, and let me sit down. And they took me up on the stage, you know. And so there was another guy. And they took him up on the stage, too. And there was three of us, old-timers, I guess you'd call us, up on the stage. And they had a cart, and they had big books stacked up about this high on the cart. And then when they got to 29 days, they brought all those people from 29 days to 24 hours up on the stage. And each one of them introduced themselves, and we took turns handing them big books. And, wow. These people with, 29 to 24 hours of sobriety, and I know exactly how they feel, full of fear and guilt and whatever, you know, and wondering how I'm going to get out of this. And anyway, I got one more thing to say that I didn't talk about. That God can do for me and for you what you can't do for yourself. And I heard that early on, and it stuck in my head, and I was trying to turn my life and will over to the care of God, and I'd let God handle things, but some things I wouldn't let God handle because I thought I could take care of them. And then it would fall apart, and then I'd have to, you know, rework the whole process again. And let God have it. And then it turned out better than I ever supposed, you know, figured out it would turn out. Because God knows what's best for me and for you. So anyway, thank you.
The memorial service for Carolyn. son Kelly is going to be at my Bicycle Lawn Club Saturday, April 9th at 2:30 p.m. All are welcome. Another announcement is June 10th at